Let's start this time today, though, with the an interestingly titled book, Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. Now, I want to start with, we're going to be talking, folks, just so you know, about remarkable stories regarding Venice, the Templars, and what do they have in common? The Holy Land, secret excavations there, the pontificate of Pope Innocent III, one of the more sinister popes. I mean, has there ever been a pope who wasn't sinister?
Well, I think but he didn't qualify in that category.
Maybe Pope Joan?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to be getting into this in just a moment. Where I would like to start with it, if you don't mind, is to get into the meaning of the phrase, the Janus Age.
Well, I chose that very deliberately, Whitley, because the way I look at it, I used to be a medieval history professor in college, and this is kind of the book I wanted to write when I was a medieval history professor, but I didn't dare, because it's so outside of the academic bailiwick. My approach throughout the book is to assume that conspiracies are nothing new, and the Middle Ages is full of them. So, to a certain extent, I chose that phrase to indicate that we are dealing not just merely with the surface sort of academic recitation of dates and times and kings and popes and emperors, but to look beneath the surface and to inquire why they're doing the things they're doing. Is there some big plan? And of course, once you say that, then you're looking square at the Templars right in the eyes, because they form such a high, crucial component during the High Middle Ages. The second reason is that the Middle Ages, whether we like it or not, the Middle Ages saw the beginning, really, of institutions that we take for granted. It saw the beginning of banking in the modern sense that we take for granted. It saw the beginning of commodities markets. It saw the beginning of the corporation. It saw the beginning of modern jurisprudence that we're familiar with. The nation state in a great degree becomes a creation of the Middle Ages. So the Middle Ages look forward to the contemporary period. But at the end of the Middle Ages and on into the High Renaissance, which is also a part of the book, and even into the early Enlightenment, with this explosion of hermetic and alchemical and Kabbalistic doctrines that you have in the northern Italian city-states, you're also looking back through centuries, quite literally, to classical civilizations and to their doctrines and to their revivals. So it's a Janus Age in that sense as well, as looking forward and as looking back. So I employed the phrase to indicate a bit of that. And I tell people, and I mean it quite literally, this is a messy book because I'm trying to do a little bit of conspiracy theory, look at the Middle Ages. I'm trying to do an exploration of the influence of hermetic doctrines on the movement, the hidden movements of the Middle Ages, and then as they burst out into the open during the Renaissance. And I'm also looking back to the influence of those doctrines on the Templars and their activities and what they may have really been looking for. So it's a messy book. It's kind of all over the board. I even do a bit of music theory in it. So, that tells you how messy it is.
I would like to go back, if we may, to the Caribbean and to some of the secret voyages. But before we do that, this is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. Right now, we're talking about Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. And one of the most interesting things about the Caribbean during the Golden Age of piracy was that the first pirates appeared in longboats and flying the Templar battle flag, which became known as the Jolly Roger.
Right.
Could you tell us about a little bit about some of these secret voyages? And I might add, let's bring up as well the fact that, let's just start there. There's so much to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I hope we can get finished in the 14 to 15 hours we have.
Well, it may take that long. The secret voyages aspect of the Middle Ages, Whitley, are the most fascinating because, as I try and detail in the book, there is no doubt that there is some sort of hidden, very secret activity, probably sponsored by the Templars, if not conducted directly by them, which I think is the case, of voyaging to the New World. And we have evidences of this, we have suggestions of this, with the Kennewick Knight, a figure in Massachusetts of a knight, on a rock, that is in full armor with carrying a Templar sword. So, you know, what's this doing in Massachusetts? All right.
Right.
We have indications like this. There is a significant story here, and that is the hidden, it's not really hidden, it was a given geopolitical fact during the Middle Ages, but it's become more or less obscured by modern academic approaches to history, and that is the alliance between the military crusading orders like the Templars and Hospitallers and the northern Italian city-states, namely Venice and Genoa in particular. The Templars were very closely allied with Venice, and the reason is, it goes back to the Fourth Crusade, and I lay all this out in the book, when you have the statement that six French knights show up in Venice at the Doge's palace, at the time that was Enrico Dandolo, the famous blind Doge of Venice, negotiating for the transport of this large crusading army to, supposedly, ostensibly, to the Middle East. And right there, that's a clue, because, of course, French knights should tell you something. It should tell you that there's a Templar connection going on here. Now, in most academic studies, in most academic textbooks, you're not going to get that sort of read on things, but the fact of the matter is, history shows us that the Fourth Crusade was diverted to, ostensibly diverted, I think it was intended to end up at Constantinople from the outset. That's another argument I'm making in the book. But we know that Templars were along because the Podesta, the Venetian Podesta that was installed after the sacking of Constantinople, was a fellow by the name of Marin Zeno, and that should really set off alarm bells right there. And we'll get to that part of the story in a moment. Zeno was installed as the Venetian Podesta, and after the Venetian Republic had more or less taken control of the northern part of the Byzantine Empire and the northern part of the Bosporus, they sent word to Pope Innocent III, a fellow by the name of Lotario Cardinal de Conti, and the man carrying this letter to the Pope, was in fact a Templar knight. So in other words, we have the presence of the Templars shortly after the Crusade had sacked Constantinople, and that to me is a huge clue. So there's this geopolitical given throughout that period of the Middle Ages that when you said Templars, you were also thinking of their allies, the Venetians. And one of the things I'm arguing in the books that they were looking for when they sacked Constantinople was hidden knowledge, and in particular, hidden cartographic knowledge that most likely came to Constantinople via Alexandria during that period prior to the 7th century that the Byzantine Empire actually ruled Egypt. So I think they uncovered this secret cartographic tradition because it is precisely after the Fourth Crusade that you begin to see these indications that there are some sort of contacts between Western Europe and North America that are being kept a very, very closely held secret. And I suspect that the reason why, Whitley, is because this was perceived as a source of bullion, which, of course, Venice would have wanted to keep very, very secret, as well as the Templars. There's another aspect of this story, and that goes to the celebrated Zeno manuscript. And let me preface what I'm going to say here that is very important. There are attempts within the academic community, and have been since this manuscript first appeared in the middle of the 16th century in London, to denounce the whole manuscript as a hoax. And these academic criticisms of the manuscript, they're very plausibly well argued, but their standard approach is academic. In other words, they're forgetting that what we're dealing with here is, number one, a Templar order, which by the time of the Zeno voyages has already been disbanded, supposedly, and is defunct. And we also have to remember that with Venice, we're dealing with probably the most studied and practiced nation-state in Western Europe at the time, in the fine arts and crafts of covert operations and intelligence, okay? So in other words, I think that in order to study this period, you literally have to take off the academic blinders and start being willing to speculate and read between the lines. Now, the Zeno manuscript purports to be a manuscript of a voyage undertaken by Niccolo and Antonio Zeno to Venetians, to the northern islands of the British Isles, the Orkney Islands and the Faroes Islands and so on. And there, according to the manuscript, they meet up with a prince who ultimately, if you read the defenders of the manuscript, turns out to be Prince Henry Sinclair, all right? And that will ring a bell for those who followed the Templar story, because the Sinclair family are alleged to have very close ties to the Templars.
I want to just jump in here very quickly. Lord John Pentland, who was the head of the Gurdjieff Foundation in the 70s and 80s,
right,
was a descendant of John Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the present John Sinclair, who is his son and is the head of the Gurdjieff Foundation in New York, is also a descendant of the same man.
Right. Well, this again is to me an indicator that you have a very tight association of that particular family.
Yes.
With esoteric doctrines and systems and with esoteric studies, and certainly hidden voyages to the New World are in that ballpark, and this is exactly what the manuscript maintains happened. That these two Venetian admirals, along with Henry Sinclair, actually undertook a voyage first to Greenland and then to North America. Now, that may seem an extravagant claim, because these claims are being made that this voyage occurred in the year 1398, almost a century before the voyage of Columbus.
And yet, look at Rosalind Chapel, look at the corn
stalks. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There are these indicators that there is some sort of contact secretly taking place. Well, the question is, why would we have Venetians involved with this? And the way I try and lay it out in the book, Quitley, is that they, along with their Templar allies, probably because of the sack of Constantinople and the recovery of some hidden cartographic tradition that begins to circulate very quietly and secretly throughout Western Europe, Genoa and the Hospitallers, the Templars, and so on, are conducting these secret voyages and bringing back with them bullion. Because it's specifically and explicitly mentioned in the Zeno manuscript that the North American Indians that they come into contact with are in possession of large amounts of gold. And of course, gold is one of the staples of international commerce and finance at that time. So
yeah,
Venice
was a foundation of all power. Really.
Absolutely. And Venice, of course, was the European bullion market at the time. So this was a hidden secret supply of bullion for the people involved in banking. And the way I lay it out in the book is that the Zeno manuscript probably, since you have the same family involved, as was the name of the family of the first Venetian governor of post-Fourth Crusade Constantinople, that in all likelihood what happened was that they recovered this and made it, so to speak, a family patrimony of that oligarchical family within the Venetian Republic. And moreover, it's very interesting in the manuscript that the Zenos that are on this voyage are described as cavalieri. In other words, they're described as knights. So again, why would they be described this way? Well, in the book, I go back and I go to the Albigensian Crusade and then ultimately to the destruction and demise of the Templar Order under King Philippe le Bel in France in the year 1307. And it's very interesting, Whitley, because if you look at that and look at what happens in Venice 3 years later, in Venice you have the founding of the Council of Ten in the year 1310. And the way I look at it is you have to connect these two things, because what do the Templars really constitute as far as Venice is concerned in their relationship with Venice? Well, they're the international arm. They're the international intelligence aspect of Venice's contacts prior to the demise of the Templars. So when they found the Council of Ten, what I really suspect they've done is they're founding, first of all, the Replacement Intelligence Agency, which is what the Council of Ten really was. And they're doing this also as a potential point of refuge for Templar knights within Italy to seek a haven where their talents and resources will be continued to be used, and used in a direct fashion by the Venetian state. So these things, in my opinion, Whitley, these things have to be looked at as part of a whole big, huge, complex political operation. The demise of the Templars, the Albigensian Crusade, the founding of the Council of Ten, the secret voyages, and so on.
That had also an inner life. In other words,
it
journeyed into the world of the soul.
Yes.
Very definitely. We're going to talk more about this when we get back. We'll be right. Whitley Strieber, we're talking to Joseph Farrell. We're going to have a fascinating extension of this conversation in the subscriber area. We're going to be talking about things like the Voynich manuscript. Joseph's got some very interesting things to say about it. I've always wanted to ask him his thoughts about it. We'll do that later, Joseph. Also, the Skull and Crossbones, which Masonic scholar P.D. Newman has identified as being a legitimate Masonic symbol,
yes,
as well, and what it means, what that symbol means, and why it is, and what the dead head was of the Templars. Now, but before we go in that direction, let's go back to medieval Europe, to Venice, and to these journeys that began to take place between the old and new worlds, led by John Sinclair. And, you know, they get me deeply, and I'll tell you why. I think there is, first of all, a very much of an intact Masonic Templar movement in Canada.
Yes.
Then they do have a lot of esoteric knowledge.
Yes.
And I can never forget that extraordinary man, the master of the key, who was so richly knowledgeable, said to me, "I'm a Canadian, but I don't pay taxes," implying that he was a Canadian from before Canada existed, and his family had simply never registered itself.
Right.
And I think of the Mi'kmaq Indians. And
oh, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Mi'kmaqs.
Well, the Mi'kmaqs figure extremely prominently in the Zeno manuscript, although they are not named as such. But it's very clear. A scholar by the name of Frederick J. Pohl, P-O-H-L, wrote a study of the Zeno manuscript and compared its assertions with the claims of the Mi'kmaq legends. And the Mi'kmaq peoples preserved several statements that find their way into Pohl's book. One of them is, first of all, that they were in contact with white people from across the ocean. And when the Zenos and Henry Sinclair show up and meet these people, most likely in some place in Nova Scotia, the extraordinary thing that they discover is that the chief that they encounter, the local tribal chief of the Mi'kmaq Nation, had in his possession books in his library in Latin. So in other words, there had been some contact even before that. And again, we go back to the fact that, you know, you've got the Kennewick Knight there in Massachusetts of this very faintly carved figure in full armor, you know,
right.
Very clearly a European knight of some sort with a Templar-looking blade. So they clearly had some contact. And the other thing that the manuscript points out is that the Micmacs not only had preserved these legends of contact with white Europeans, but and these extraordinarily Latin books in their libraries, but that they also were in possession of large amounts of gold. And of course, once you say that again, you're saying that there's a financial interest in these voyages. And in my opinion, they were probably bringing back bullion, in some form or another through trade with the Indians and secretly using that as a hidden source or a hidden reserve to what was going on in Venice at the time in the commodities market. So it's a huge story. The Micmacs are definitely a part of this whole tradition. And you're absolutely correct. The Canadians do appear to have some sort of Masonic Templar distinction in their version of Masonry. But I want to address something else that you've raised. And that's the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones flag. Because I point out at the Council of Vienne in France, not Vienna, the people often get the two confused, but this was a council that took place in a little French village of Vienne that actually was the council that formally disbanded the Templars. And then this was later certified by Pope Clement V. And the interesting thing in this council, Whitley, is that the council decreed that absolutely, for all time, no Templar insignia whatsoever could be publicly displayed. This included Jolly Rogers. This included also the familiar Templar corporate logo, so to speak, of the Red Cross on the white background. And yet, when we get to Columbus is sailing with the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria with big red crosses boldly emblazoned on the white sails.
Right.
So, you know, again, there's a very clear, bold, symbolic proclamation that we're doing this under the aegis of something more than just King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. And when you add this to the fact that in the Spanish capitulations that were signed between Columbus and the two Spanish monarchs, when the signing was done, Queen Isabella made a very, very significant statement to Columbus, apparently. And the statement was to the effect that, sir, it would seem that you know a great deal more about these worlds than, and her implication was, than was possible with just guesswork or reading. In other words, she was implying that he had actually probably undertaken some secret voyages to the New World before, even on his own.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, it gets even more fascinating, Whitley, because on the tomb of Pope Innocent VIII, Giovanni Cardinal Cibo, who was actually a Genoan like Columbus, Giovanni Cibo, on his tomb in Rome, you can see Columbus's esoteric signature boldly stamped on the Pope's tomb. And the question is why?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, I ran in my researches into a wonderful Italian scholar by the name of Ruggiero Marino, and I kind of review his work in the book. And Marino comes to the conclusion that Columbus may have been one of the Pope's many children. And now here's the really interesting thing about this. When Cardinal Cibo was in the conclave that eventually elected him Pope, his other opponent was described as a knight, as was Cibo. So in other words, both papal candidates in that conclave that eventually elected him to be Pope Innocent VIII were apparently members of the crusading military orders, but we're not told which ones. We only know that they were described as knights. Now, I know that may seem like I'm stretching a point here, but people have to remember what a knight represented back during that period of time. A knight was a complex, very expensive military technology. In other words, you had to have a kind of military industrial complex behind you to make your armor, to stall your horses, to take your squires into battle to prepare you with the armor and everything. So it was a very complex military technology that required financing. This is why the crusading orders arose in the first place. You had to create a kind of transnational European-wide military industrial complex. That's really what they were. And Chibo, of course, represents one of these. We don't know what, but interestingly enough, Chibo was not only described as a knight, he was a nephew of a Muslim, he had Jewish blood, and of course he was a Christian. So in other words, the way they looked at it, he was kind of a prophetic fulfillment to stage the announcement of the New World. And of course, Columbus coming from Genoa, we have Ferdinand and Isabella with their connections to the Genoese bankers, to the De Medicis in Florence. So there's something going on here beyond just Ferdinand and Isabella, backing a crazy scheme to go find the New World. I think really what you have is Ferdinand and Isabella and Columbus are kind of the public fronts for a very old agenda that's being driven by these military crusading orders that already know all about it. So I told you this was a messy book.
Yeah, well, it is a bit, but at the same time, this kind of knowledge is foundational. Yes. If you understand this, you understand the flow of money and the flow of power right up to and including organizations like the Trilateral Commission.
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
And when we continue, we're going to get into some of the deep secrets that are involved here, because after all, we're talking about a time now when the Templars were at the pinnacle of power.
Oh, yes.
But something happened. Something happened, folks, and they lost that position very terribly and very dramatically. Joseph Farrell knows why, and he knows a lot about the flow of energy, the flow of dark and light energy in this world, as it is expressed directly in our lives through these hidden forces. Joseph's new book is Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. Joseph